Thank you for joining us today for the Institute for Literacy and Learning's live chat conference call series, which is being recorded. Today, we have the pleasure of being joined by distinguished reading researcher, Dr. Marilyn Adams, discussing Soliloquy Learning Reading Assistant. Before we start, though, I have some very important messages and housekeeping details. If you haven't done so already, please mute your phones throughout the conference call, and please do not put your phones on hold. Second, if you have a question for Dr. Adams, please email it to straighttalklivechat@theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. Again, the email address is straighttalklivechat@theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. No spaces. Emailed questions and their answers will be mailed to everyone registered for this call in the next couple of days. I also encourage you to help us help you by telling us at the Institute for Literacy and Learning which topics you'd like to hear about for future live chat conference calls with the experts. We would very much appreciate it if everyone could also please email us your contact information to straighttalklivechat@theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org with Dr. Adams in the subject line, because many times one person signs up for the call, but several people sit in on the call together. We are not able to capture our entire audience and are not able to follow up with everyone after the call. So we're asking that everyone please email us your contact information and let us know that you were on the call so we can follow up with you appropriately. The Institute for Literacy and Learning is hosting week-long conferences with the experts this summer. Dr. Jan Hasbrook will be presenting the best practices of literacy coaching from July 9th through 13th at Harrisburg University in downtown Harrisburg, PA. And Dr. Louisa Motz will be presenting the best practices of teaching reading from June 25th through 29th at the Penn State and State College, PA. For more information about these conferences, please log on to the Institute for Literacy and Learning's website at www.theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. As an added bonus for Straight Talk Live Chat participants, you are entitled to register for these summer conferences at a special price of $999, which is one-third off of the original price of $1,500. Please mention that you were a Straight Talk Live Chat participant, and you will be receiving this special pricing as a bonus for joining on this call today. In the next couple of days, please check your inboxes or our website for next month's Institute for Literacy and Learning's live chat conference call. Thank you, everyone, again for joining us today, and now I would like to present renowned reading researcher Dr. Marilyn Adams, speaking about the groundbreaking guided reading technology, Soliloquy Learning Reading Assistant. Dr. Adams?
Good afternoon to all of you. Thank you for joining us. What I'm planning to do is to talk a little bit about what I've been doing and then to open up for questions, because this is rather a complex area, and I'm here for you. So it's best if we use the time to respond to your needs. So what I want to do today is tell you about a project that I've been working on for really the last 10 years, 15 years actually. And this is a project in which the basic goal has been to use speech recognition, automated speech recognition, is everybody familiar?
Yeah.
Okay. To give the computer ears, in effect. That is to develop the computer so that it can listen to children. I think that you know, we hope that technology will be a good solution towards providing individualized instruction, towards giving teachers more time to do clinical work and less management activity, towards making sure that children have the support and assignments that are appropriate to them, and that they get them done with the support and encouragement that they need, and the teacher gets feedback so that she can spend her time less shepherding the kids than addressing their real needs and encouraging their strengths and enthusiasm. And it has not It's worked fairly well in physics and in mathematics and in domains such as computer programming, but it's always been a bit disappointing in the domain of literacy. And my sense is that part of the problem, a large part of the problem, is that the computer knows when a child has answered a math question, because the child writes in the answer and the computer can tell if it's right or wrong. But when you try to develop analogous programs for reading, the computer is deaf, dumb, and blind, and just can't respond to the child. Instead, it pops up with weird questions on the side or expects them to get it. Anyway, this is my goal, to develop the computer's sensibility and sensitivity to listening to children read, and interacting with them, to make computers truly interactive, to bring the hyper into hypertext, as it were. So, one of the motivations, one of the big motivations, the big triggers for this work, is in fact the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the NAEP, as it's called, NAEP. The NAEP was put into place in the 1960s in the wake of Brown versus Board of Education during the War on Poverty. And the purpose of the NAEP, the dream of the NAEP, was that we would be able to have a national assessment that was cross-state, cross-ethnicity, that we could use to help us to close the gap between the have and have-not schools. That was our dream. It was not politically easy because, as you know, the Constitution preserves education. It puts educational management into the province of the state, not the federal government. And it's expensive, and it really wasn't clear at all how to do it without technology. And states were, I think, appropriately concerned that they didn't want the federal government telling them how or what to teach their students or compare them across states on things that they weren't sure were appropriate. But finally, after 30 years, you know, policy moves like a glacier, right? After 30 years, in 1990, they finally came together, the policy, the funding, and the spirit and technology, importantly, to really do present the first real NAEP. It was an assessment of reading that went across states. Not all the states participated, but nearly all. And we got back the results, and we've now been working on this problem of civil liberties and equal education for 30 years, and so we were all ready to revel in our results. And instead, what we found was not only that the gap was breathtakingly large, wide, but also that none of our children, or our children as a group, regardless of state or ethnicity, were not performing at levels that we conceived of as grade level. On the NAEP, is basically, it's a criterion reference test. And the performance is divided into three bands. Grade level is labeled proficient. On the NAEP, it's designed, proficient is grade level. And then there's a band above that called a band. And those are your little wizards, the ones who are just wonderful. And there's a band below that called basic. And those are kids who are coming along, but they need extra support, extra shepherding, extra help to make sure that they stay on pace and are ready for the lessons that will be offered by the next grade. And what we found on that 92 NAEP, to our total surprise, was that nearly half of our fourth grade students were scoring below basic, that is below the bottom category on the NAEP, so below grade level on the NAEP. And again, the gap between the have and have not schools was very pronounced. So therewith was born the reading initiative, and kind of watched across the 90s as there was report after report. There was the Academy of Sciences report, the National Reading Panel report, the Learning First Alliance report. And as we listened also to governor after governor stand up in February and announce in his state of the state address that all children in his or her state would be reading by age 9. And that then culminated in the No Child Left Behind Act, which took the many of the policies and measures and dynamics of the K-3 reading initiative. It was really a primary grade initiative nationwide. It was a primary grade initiative for two reasons. One was that we had data that showed that children who were in trouble at the end of first grade tended stubbornly to stay in trouble. I mean, not individually. You can certainly take a child individually and find a tutoring experience for that child or a learning experience that, that will bring them, you know, right up to pace and beyond. But as a group, for children as a group, that is in a large number, children who were in trouble at the end of first grade tended to stay in trouble throughout their school years. And by in trouble, I mean not just that their reading achievement didn't progress, but neither did their school achievement in general, and neither did their happiness as measured by all various measures such as dropping out of school, getting into trouble. So the hope was that by focusing energy on the early years, you get kids off to a really good start. You get kids on the tools they needed to move ahead and the confidence they needed to work on difficulties on their own rather than feeling like they just couldn't do it. And in addition, of course, 1990 was the height of the whole language movement, and there was much concern that, or there was much hope, perhaps. We're not really sure how our own heads work. But the results of the NAEP were so jarring that I think many of us hoped that they were a local disturbance, that if we would just teach children the basics, that our most of our children would score at proficient, aka grade level. So there was a big emphasis on the basics for two reasons. One having to do with instructional theory and one having to do with statistical empirical findings about why the beginning grades are so important. So what's happened now is by 2005 is that we have succeeded the NAEP 2005, which was the last national NAEP, had significantly better scores from all children, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of state, regardless of ethnicity, across the nation and regardless of poverty, all of the children scored better. But it wasn't a huge increase. And the gap did not shrink at all. In between 1990 and 1995, we have had reading assessments every 2 or 4 years, and we've had special assessments for the urban centers. And what you see as you look at each one of them, that gap is broad. That gap shows us that for those children who depend most of all on schooling for their formal education, our schools are not doing what they need to. Our schools we still aren't getting there. And so my story was, what triggered me to develop this technology? By staring at this gap, whether on the NAEP or in individual research papers, I watched children catching on to phonemic awareness quickly. Letters must be taught and must be made comfortable. If children are comfortable with their letters, it's forever a burden. But I can teach those. I can do phonemic awareness quite quickly. I can teach phonics. But the NAEP is in fourth grade. The NAEP is about real reading. It's about comprehension. It's about vocabulary. It's about stepping into literacy. The best predictor is fourth grade and up of reading our comprehension, our vocabulary, and our really literary experience, whether it's from parents reading at home with their children or children reading themselves. And that continues to be true all the way through school and as long as we measure people. And so every 2 years, as that gap shows up, and otherwise through my research papers, I stare at it and say, how much? We've now worked on the basics. We've worked quite hard, and we have good indicators that we've done a good job. Children are learning, but there's still a stretch for literacy for all children, and most especially for the children in the schools of poverty. So I stare at that gap and say, well, how much of that is due to how often children are read to, how deeply they're immersed in literacy, in the world of literature, in the language of books? How much of it is due to how often their caretakers, their mommies and daddies and people at home are able to capture them and say, please read with me, or let me read with you, or let's read this together, or, and these are affordances, these are almost irrepressible affordances of coming from an educated home. But they're not regular activities in many of the homes of our children. Many homes don't have the books to do it. Many homes don't have parents who know that this is their job. Many homes have parents who try, but when things get out of hand, it's easy to get into to tiffs with your child when you try to insist that they read with you. And many homes feel, many parents came to America because we boast that we have public schools. And public schools will teach your child. And they don't know that in the educated American home, there's a whole lot of tutoring going on that's in vital confidence to school. If you look to the schools and say, well, can the schools do it? How will the schools do it? It's very interesting. If beyond the basics, reading is the single thoughtful reading, right? The single most important activity toward becoming literate. We're becoming literate knowing the language and the modes of thought and the pleasures and just becoming a comfortable, thoughtful reader. The most important activity beyond the basics is that of reading. And most especially that of reading with help, with someone who helps you with the confusing ideas and with the allusions to, in the days of Columbus, you know, that's not about Ohio. Those are the most important activities for reading, and so the National Reading Panel appropriately urged teachers to spend more time addressing that activity. And yet, how do you do that at school? How do you spend time one-on-one working with every child, responding exactly to the hesitation you sense in their voice? I mean, we could read aloud chorally, but if you walk around the back of somebody's classroom and peer over the kid's shoulders, it turns out that precious few of them are even looking at the same page. You can ask children to read aloud by themselves independently with a tape or same silent reading or any number of activities, all of which have a common failing that the children who need that time the most are least likely to spend it well, because their reading is troubled. They will get the least done during that time. If you read 50 words a minute, you're reading a third or a quarter as much as a child is reading comfortably. Okay, so how do you get this done? We have dynamics, and they're the least robust for the children who need them most. Oh, and also, of course, the children who need them most also need help most. And individual help is always the best help when you're beginning to read, because it helps capture the child's interest, it helps to reward them for their successes, it helps when you're reading with a child, you're not just correcting them, you're bringing life to the story and pausing at the right point. Saying, oh, why did the chicken do that? Or how are they going to fix that problem? These are all very critical to registering the book and building the conceptual underpinnings that will make it stick. And you review words, vocabulary. So, in the normal classroom, let's say there are 25 kids in a classroom, that means that if the teacher does nothing but individual work all day long, then she gets, and that she minimizes transition time between children, and she gets about 2 minutes per child per hour to work. But we can't do individual work all day long. There's many, many other activities in the classroom and school day to which we must attend. Besides which, for every 2 minutes you're working with a child, there are 24 out there who need help spending their time well. So if you work, it just can't be done in the classroom. So I was working at a geeky, techie place in Cambridge, Massachusetts, this place called Volt Boranic and Newman, or BDN Technologies, which I'm very lucky to have been a member of. And we had a huge speech recognition department. Guys from MIT mostly, who did speech recognition as the love of their life. And I said, hey, could we take this speech recognition and put it on a computer that's appropriate to the classroom, instead of breaking workstation? And could we slip it underneath something like Living Books, that is, text on screen that has hot spots for clicking words, you can listen to the narrator, and you can get different definitions and graphics and whatever else, and all of the bells and whistles that make computers a little bit livelier than a book. But can we take speech recognition and just slip it in underneath the story so that when the children are reading, when the students are reading, the computer can listen. If they get stuck, the computer can get them out then and there. As they're reading, it can always know where they are, and it can ask them questions about what they read. Potentially, it could be the truly hyper-text experience. So, you know, if it was a dark and windy night, the computer might whoosh. Anyway, that's the dream. And so we worked very hard. It was a very difficult problem, required lots of time, required engineering brilliance, speech scientists and software engineering. And it required that computers mature a little bit so that there would be a classroom computer that, had a big enough memory and could deliver, the assets that make the reading that make the whole thing work. And that happened around the year 2000 when Apple came out with its new platform and the PC got past their Y2K problem. So now we have software and that listens to children read, and it's turned out to be just a delight both in working with the children. We've also had, of course, been uncountable hours working in classrooms, collaborating with teachers and with clinicians to try and cause the machine to act as gracefully and as supportively as a good clinician, rather than rudely and interrupting all the time. So, the machine that we have now, the software that we have now, is both a wonderful research bench and a ever more valuable tutorial bench. Our first set of software that we put out was stories for the children to read with the computer, getting help, and in some cases those stories are modeled directly after guided reading. That is, the emphasis is on keeping the children involved in the comprehension and giving them the feedback and the help and in the story, understanding, returning their attention to problem spots, but not interrupting when they're on a roll. That we, the software, takes difficulties that aren't as critical or where the child was on a roll and puts them on a problem list to review later, just as you would do when you read the child. And we've learned a great deal about fluency along the way too. So, which helps us build, reports in the background. Not only build the interaction with the students, but also a report that we give to the teacher. Remember, there are two goals here. One is to give the students, every student, ample supported opportunity to read and to benefit from reading. And the other is to give the teacher the information that she or he needs in order to know exactly where the child is, to make sure the child, you know, reading and applying herself or himself, but also to be able to monitor their progress and their difficulties so that now we've done two things in terms of that classroom management challenge. One is we've created a way for every child to read with individual support. And we've created an opportunity for the teacher to work as productively as possible with each individual. That is, when she's spending her time one-on-one with a child, the other one can be reading with a computer. And so that means that we know they're spending their time well. It's a good way for them to spend their time. I didn't know that when I went back to the tape recorder. So the issues in fluency has been a very, very hot topic in our school in the last year. The reason fluency has been a very hot topic, the number one reason is that when you get out that stopwatch and you time students reading in correct words per minute, it turns out that that measure, how quickly or fluently the child reads in correct words per minute, is a very good predictor of full-scale reading. That is, how well they would score in a full-scale reading test, such as your end-of-the-year test or your state test. It's also a good predictor of vocabulary tests, a good predictor of their decoding or word recognition tests. And so for a one-minute measure, it does very well. And similarly, when students are given tutorial activities to develop their fluency, which principally, no matter what it's called, means having somebody who knows how to read, sit down, and keep them on task, and get them to enjoy and learn from the book, and revisit their difficulties, then you find that you get growth not only in their fluency, but also in their word recognition, their vocabulary, their language, their comprehension. So, both sides of that coin look really great, with only one little hazard spot. And the hazard spot is that because it's effectively rate words correct per minute, that is this good measure. Sometimes when it's taken to classrooms, the goal somehow becomes one of encouraging the children to read faster. And that's teaching to the test in a way that you don't want to do. And just to visit this with you for a little bit, the correlation is such that children with higher words per minute have higher vocabulary comprehension, full-scale reading, than the children with low words per minute. Okay? That's why there's this temptation. Oh, let's teach them all to read faster. But I just want you to visit in your head the situation where you're well into the school year, your classroom routine is down, everybody's moving along the way. You like them too, and sort it into groups and assignments and whatever, and the door opens and a new child walks in. And you have to get that child integrated into your classroom as quickly and as comfortably as possible, productively. What do you do? What do you do when the child comes in? One of the first things that people just instinctively do, teachers, is they say, this is one of the books that they're working with in the classroom, and they say, let me just show you some of the books we're reading here. Why don't you sit down and read a couple pages with me? And you know from listening, you know whether that child is going to move in comfortably, whether they're going to need extra support, whether they're wizards. You know, as you listen, things at a great level of detail. You know which words they're having trouble with, whether they have their phonics, which words are likely vocabulary problems, if this is a topic that's familiar to them. You know, all those things from listening. And so imagine that you've read this story with the children, this, you know, two-page story. And then when you finished, what would you do? Supposing they had difficulty. Some difficulties that they read. very likely what you do is you say, okay, let's go back to this sentence. Let's look at this word. Let's read this sentence. What is the author trying to say here? Okay, so, you go over all the things that you sense difficulty with. And you say, maybe read this sentence again. You read that word. All those things that you just naturally do. And then you say, okay, let's read it again. And read it again. The child would read better, right? And if you timed it with a stopwatch, she or he would be quicker in terms of words correct per minute. So words correct per minute is a good measure because for two reasons. One is that all of those difficulties, you're not a mind reader. You heard them struggle on those words. You heard them get sluggish on those sentences. You heard them listen to see if they could figure out the meaning of that sentence. All those things take time. When they sounded and thought it took time. So what the stopwatch does for you is it measures the number and the severity of problem spots that the child encountered while reading the text. Right? The more time they took, the more problems they were, the tougher they were for the child to get past. And as the child has fewer and fewer problem spots, begins to conquer things, it just takes less time. So that's why it correlates. So if we want to address this correlation, what we have to do is focus on the causes of reading disfluency, not on having kids read faster. They will read faster as it begins to make sense, begins to be perceived and understood as language and as a story. And that's what we've tried to do with the software. Now, as you look at the research, or as you look, this is where I said the software is such a good reading bench, research bench, excuse me. When the children stumble on words, the software will help them then and there or put it on the list. So you end up, as a teacher who's trying to help the children, not only getting their audio recording from their session, but the audio recording is marked up, so the words that they had trouble with are marked in red. And you can very quickly look through their recordings and decide what you want to listen to. There are also lists of words for you to deal with. So you can very quickly decide which of the passages do I want to work with this child. What is his zone of proximal development? What is his instructional level? Because I'm the instructor. We want to do this as helpfully as possible. Not too hard, not too easy. We want to address real problems. Vocabulary is also a problem. The words that the kids look up are listed for you, but rather than, I think it's hard to understate the importance of vocabulary for young readers. As you guys probably know, vocabulary tests, grades 4 and up, correlate so well with reading comprehension that there's, you can almost use one as a substitute for the other. And there's a reason for that. A large part of the reason, and this is important for you to tuck away, is that oral language and written language use a very different vocabulary. So 96% of oral language is accounted for by just a few thousand words, fewer than 5,000. That means that a child with a vocabulary of fewer than 5,000 words is going to sound perfectly fluent, perfectly well-versed in English, have a perfectly useful vocabulary. You cannot tell by listening to a child speak or by discussing with them in casual conversation whether they have an adequate vocabulary for reading. In reading, it has been estimated that the number of words that are needed by the time you graduated from high school are 50,000 by one estimate. The Oxford English Dictionary people estimate that if you don't count inflections, that is walk and walk, and walking all count as one word, just go through and count words that are in everyday English, not obsolete, that the number is 250,000. That's a lot more than 5,000, right? How many times more is that? Now you don't need all those words because words cluster in topics. That is, when you're reading about Columbus, there are words that matter there. When you're reading about the Revolutionary War, there are words that matter there. When you're reading about photosynthesis, there are words that matter there. But the only way that define words or give you the meaning of words is through words. And in order for children to begin to learn about words and concepts through text, they must understand the text, and that reciprocally depends on understanding the words. Turns out, and this has been replicated several times, that unless kids understand 95% of the text, comprehension is gone. Comprehension is just gone. So they are allowed to not understand one word in 20. Otherwise, the text just, you know, it just doesn't go together. And counting words in that way where I'm counting them by what they look like is not fair either. I've seen it estimated that the average English word has 7 meanings. The only way you learn about the different meanings and behaviors of words and the context in which they like to travel is by encountering them in context. So all of those factors, because the words only live in written text, text offers big demands, and big demands on young readers' vocabulary, but it also offers the opportunity. The problem is it's not an opportunity if they're stuck. It's not an opportunity if they don't understand. So my challenge when I was trying to build this was, how do I get a book with ears? I want a book that will listen, a book that will help, a book that will delight them and keep them on task. And that's what we've been trying to do with this software. I think that's sort of in terms of research and application. And I'd like to stop doing my monologue to invite you to ask questions, because I know this is a really complex area and I'm worried about running off in the directions that you don't care about at the expense of those you do.
Okay, Dr. Adams, our first question is, our system is committed to the 3-tier model. Please talk about how the reading assistant is best used in the RTI model.
Oh, that's a really good question. Okay. I think, as an overview, by the way, a simple overview of the RTI model, that the site at Lehigh does an admirable job. And I don't know the URL, but you can get there by Googling RTI and Lehigh, as in Lehigh University right there in Bethlehem. And I can turn the question into a question of, is reading with children, or reading with a student, appropriate for children in Tier 1, Tier 2, or Tier 3? And I want you to think about that very carefully, because very often I'm asked if reading aloud is something that should only be done with second graders, to which my answer is no. Very often with my graduate students at Brown University, when we have heard articles, we say, okay, let's read it together. Let's take turns. Why is he saying that? What is he alluding to? What is that word? What is that measure? What is that, you know? And we read a lot. Rereading, it's not just for developing fluency. When you have a math problem or a memo or a newspaper article that's very important to you, you read it again. Rereading is what we do to secure our understanding and make sure that we've gotten it in right. So the question on Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3 is not who to use it with, but how to use it. And what we're doing in our space is using it as a whole class activity in Tier 1. That is, the students all need to read, they all need to do vocabulary. It's a perfect forum. Wouldn't you love it if you could watch in a class or begin a discussion of a reading with the assumption that all of your students had read it? It just changes the whole mood of the discussion. So we read it, we use it together with students for Tier 1 for tier two, and because of the network reports, you can also watch carefully who's having what kind of trouble, who's okay, and who's not, who's able to get really done and assign a lot of who's not, which gives you tier two students in itself. So tier two, I prefer to use it. I recommend using it by taking the children and truly making a small group for those kids. And in this case, the reading with a computer is supplemented with coaching, the small group reading and discussion and vocabulary review. To make sure that they're understanding and watching their scores, addressing their issues. Again, the children reporting their reading is captured by the computer, and it's very helpful to save an early reading and a later reading to their portfolios. Their portfolios, so they can experience their progress. It's very useful sometimes to relay those things and to play reading aloud so they can hear what it is you're trying to help them with. They can hear if they're constantly reading off the empty words or not paying attention to the empty words. But very often they will say, and then tier three, I think that the balance is split where we individually with a child, but the soliloquy software is so useful in some occasions, and it's after working individually with a child, still with this small tweak, one of and the support. The idea of the software is that you try to get them to notice and conquer their difficulties rather than blowing them off, which is so tempting. So there you go. Tier one is full class. In our elementary class, it's fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. In our science and social studies library, it's standards-based science and social studies. But they give articles. It presents our articles. It tries to find fiction articles that it kind of bring that textbook alive and give the children a picture for what they were learning about. And the whole class read it together and discuss the concept together. So that was a long answer. I hope it was.
Thank you, Dr. Adams. The next question asked is, are there students for whom the reading assistant is not appropriate? And how do I decide which students are most appropriate for the program?
Again, the issue of most appropriate is what do you want them to be? What is the right text and what is the right setting? Is this a student who's going to need more or less individual support? And do I want them to be reading easier or harder text? Are there students for whom the software is not appropriate? The software assumes that the child has the independent decoding capability and word recognition capability that if they do stop and pay attention to a difficult word, they can sound it out. If you tell them what it is and make them look at it, they do have the decoding capability to see how that fits. If a child does not have their alphabetic basics or does not have good working knowledge of those alphabetic basics, then that's a priority. You need to pull them out and work with them on those abilities until they're comfortable. And again, happily, the machine will just mark up all the words, and you can say, oh, I better listen to this child. I do have to say I've been surprised at the number of students who are able to read at marginal fluency. That is not alarming, but, you know, right around my cutoff, maybe I have time to work with them and maybe not, at a, you know, 100 words a minute or even higher, who, when you listen to them reading with a machine, they've clearly rote memorized their way to literacy. Every new word they run into, they're helpless. And that's a very nice thing, especially as you get to the older grades where you don't have that kind of opportunity to listen to them normally and you don't know why they're not reading their homework.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dr. Adams. The next question, does the reading assistance software qualify as SBRR?
The reading assistance software, we're busy working our little butts off to do research. And so far we have one study that's published, which is the one I sent you, and we're doing a journal article version of that, which was with mainstream 2nd through 5th graders in a medium income, medium achievement town in Massachusetts. And what we found in that study was that over all grades, the effect size between the expected and achieved fluency gains was 0.9, which I'm very proud of. So we have one out, and we have many other studies underway, including a number by third-party groups. I love it when other research groups wish to use software to do studies. In addition, we just were re-reviewed by the Florida Center for Reading Research, and that review was posted today. I think that's what, www.fcrr.org. I think you did a wonderful job, and I'm very proud of it. I think this is a really important question. If you get a toaster that's a lemon, you can return it. We shouldn't have lemons in our schoolware. And it's very important to ask the publishers or vendors, aside from the fact that you like it, is it any good? So thank you for asking that.
Thank you. The next question, what kind of training comes with the program?
The training that comes with the program, includes two sessions. One is an introductory session where we work with teachers who are going to use the program. And we actually sit them down and have them use it, have them be students, and practice turning it on and off, and we booby trap their machines when they turn their backs and things like that, so they could be pretty good problem solvers. So that's the first one. It familiarizes you with the technology, with its use, with its management, and with its content and dynamics. And then we come back after a month or so and work with the teachers again, both to address any issues and questions and thoughts and ideas, but most importantly, to take them at that point into the network reports. The network reports have a whole lot of information, both individually and for purposes of looking at trend lines for your class, looking at titles and their difficulties. And so after you've got some data on your students, in your own students, in your classroom, you like to come back and say, okay, let's open it up and let's see what we can learn about how best to address these students, how best to address these children. And I would like to say that it's very important to surround anything you do with discussion and classroom attention. Otherwise, you get that, you're liable to get that too familiar response. She doesn't really care if we do it because she never really asks us about it. That's on the minus side. On the plus side, now that they've read something, wake them up. Let them talk about them. Let them recognize and realize that they learned something that's kind of cool. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. A technology question came in. I have a question about technology, sorry. Does the software run on Macs or PCs? And does the computer need to be high-end? Do we need a fancy server, and what other equipment is needed?
Important question. The software runs on both PCs and Macs, and it requires System 10 up on the Macintosh, and it requires Windows or PC 2000. Sorry, I'm a Mac person, obviously. You know, past Y2K and up on the PC and or Vista. So that's just regular computers. The computers, bless their hearts, grew to our needs. We didn't have to adjust much to their capabilities. You do need to have a headset, which comes with the software. It's a speech recognition headset that comes with the software. And in terms of servers, you have two choices. You can use a school server which we'll provide to you all loaded if you like. Or you can subscribe to the software over the internet, that is, you know, through a web application. And that's kind of nice because it means that anybody with a, who's enrolled in the software, be it a student or a teacher, can also use it on a library machine or any school machine, or you as a teacher can review your student's work at home, which I think is really important to be able to there's so much work to do, to be able to do it where you are rather than be where you need to do it. Did I answer that well enough?
That sounds great. Thank you. Another question. Soliloquy learning sounds exciting, but I'd like to see it work. Is there a way for teachers in my building to see a demo of the program?
Sweetheart. Yes. Let's see. There are several ways for you to see a demo of the program. The easiest way, the most immediate way, is if you go to the Soliloquy Learning website. There are videos. The Soliloquy Learning website, this is the problem of being a small, tiny company. It's totally unspellable. So let me spell it for you. It's www.soliloquy. Learning without a space. soliloquylearning.com. And on that homepage, on the left-hand side, there's a video that gives you lets you watch a little one using the software. And underneath that is a quick video that lets you take a tutorial and see how it works, sort of sit in the student's eye view and go through the machine. And underneath that is a video that displays some of the capabilities, some of the information on the network report. And they're all quite brief, but it's a good way to do it. If you want more, there's a customer service number and website. You can contact us. And the Institute for Learning and Step-by-Step Learning is happy to help you and come to your school if you'd like. There are partners down there in Pennsylvania.
Great. Thank you. And the question we're going to wrap up with today, Dr. Adams, is, do you have some good recommendations for further reading about fluency, vocabulary, and reading growth?
Oh, yeah. We've learned so much over the last few years. So my recommendations, I have three, I actually thought you might ask this, so I wrote down three books that I thought would be useful to read. Well, I wrote down two books that I thought would be useful to read and one that comes with a warning. The one that comes with a warning is that book that I wrote, Beginning to Read, Thinking and Learning About Print. And what I suggest to people when they read that is that when they get to the middle section, that it has all the bitwise research, they read the first chapter and then move on to the fourth section. And then they can go back and read that middle section when they want to. But I hate to lose people with all that bitwise research when it comes back up in the fourth section and goes back to children and reading. That's my warning on that one. That's Adam's Beginning to Read. And then two books that I think are especially useful is a new book by Don Hirsch, by Edie Hirsch, called The Knowledge Deficit, in which he does a really good job discussing the importance of reading and vocabulary and knowledge conceptual development in the past to literacy. It's called The Knowledge Deficit, E-F-I-C-I-T, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin, and the author is Hirsch, H-I-R-S-C-H. And then the third, there's a little book that IRA released last fall called What Research Has to Say About Fluency Instruction. And it's an anthology from some of the best minds in the business, and some of them are contrary to each other, which only makes it more fun, but it's also across them in terms of information. It's edited by Jay Samuels, S-A-M-U-E-L-S, and Alan Farska, F-A-R-S-C-R-U-P. And that's an IRA book, so if you go on reading.org, go into their books, you can buy it there.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dr. Adams. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Again, I'd like to remind you about the Institute for Literacy and Learning Summer Conferences. We're offering the best practices of literacy coaching with Dr. Jan Hasbrook from July 9th through 13th at Harrisburg University, and the best practices of teaching reading by Dr. Louisa Motes from June 25th through 29th at Penn State or in State College, PA. And as a bonus to you for joining us on today's call, mention you're a Straight Talk Live Chat call participant and receive special pricing of $999, which is one-third off of the enrollment price of $1,500 when you register for this call at www.theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. Thank you again, Dr. Adams, for helping us understand how to save more children from reading failure. Could everyone please join me in unmuting your phones and giving Dr. Adams a round of applause? Thank you, Dr. Adams.
Oh, you guys are the best. Thank you for having me. I'm honored, and I hope I was a little bit helpful and made some sense.
Thank you so much. You certainly were. Have a great week.
Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.